Before we go on, from Whispers from Eternity, usually in our, what used to be normal, in our new normal, I get to read this instead of having one of our wonderful congregation members read this. So this one is, make me a lion of thy all-conquering wisdom. I, a lion cub of the Divine Mother, found myself thrown into life among the sheep of human frailties, of fear, failure, and disease. Living long among them, I learned to bleat with weakness, forgetting my lion nature and its roars, which could frighten away all petty, pestering sorrows. O lion of realization, thou didst drag me away from those bleating sheep to the mirror smooth water of meditation. There didst thou cry, gaze. But I held my eyes tightly shut, bleating with fear. Thy roar of wisdom then reverberated through my body. Thou madest me by hard shaking and spiritual urging, open my eyes. And there, lo, in the crystal pool of my inner peace, I saw my features to be even as thine own. Now I know myself as the lion of cosmic power. I will bleat no more with fear, weakness, and suffering, for I roar now with vibrant, almighty power. I bound about through the forest of all experiences, seizing little creatures of vexing worries, timid fears, and wild hyenas of disbelief, devouring them ruthlessly. O lion of immortality, roar through me thine all-conquering power of wisdom. Master never does anything by halfway measures. And Swami had to edit that book down a little bit. Not in power, you have to understand me. But Swamiji said he just would put layer upon layer of image together until you lost the thread. So what he did was just parse it apart a little and make it a little more easy to access. But you can see, Master, what power he had. You know, I mean, I read it with almost a humorous touch, but he didn't mean it with a humorous touch. He meant we thought we were bleating sheep of weakness, and God ripped us away and said, no, thou art lion-like in thy power. And you can feel Master's just bubbling mirth. That's how Swami described it when he was editing. He said Master's devotion would just roll upon roll, and it would just be, you know, the turtles swimming in the water, flying through the air, then landing on the trees, and then bursting into flowers. And Swami just sort of took a few of the images and made it a little more clear. He said Master just couldn't contain his exuberance for the divine experience, and he wanted so much for us to have it. In the introduction to Whispers from Eternity, he urges the reader to penetrate beyond ink and paper to the living presence of God that is in the pages of this book. And if you do, you will find it. Now, this power of Master expressed in this absolutely wonderful form is exactly what our Palm Sunday service is about. It's quite a parallel, because the power of Jesus, well, Swamiji said by the end of his life that he was convinced that Master, in fact, had been Jesus, but that's quite apart from it. Nonetheless, the power of the avatars is truly infinite. And when we go into the historical story of what was happening with Jesus at the time of Palm Sunday, we can really live that story in a way that will make this coming week so powerful for us. All of us whose lives have been so interrupted, and we suddenly have so much more solitude, even if we're still working from home, we have so much more opportunity to be with ourselves. This Easter week can be an Easter week like we've never experienced before, because we have the power together to concentrate on it. So this is the end of Jesus' 3.5 years of public ministry in the land of Judah, in Jerusalem, and all over what is now that area of Israel in the world. Bear in mind, Jesus was born into that world at the age of 12. In the Bible, he essentially disappears. The historic record in the Bible goes silent. Master said, and now it's really actually just becoming common knowledge, that in fact, Jesus went to India, returning the visit of the three wise men, is how Master put it. And Master himself declared that the three wise men were Sri Yukteswar, Lahiri, and Babaji, who came to Jesus in his infancy to welcome him, you know, into this incarnation and into this life stream. This is why Jesus' picture is with the other masters on our altar, that this is one continuous teaching. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not trying to sort of claim all religions and put them within the walls of this church. It's rather the power of the masters, all the enlightened masters work together to help mankind, to individual souls, to reach that same state of realization, to drag us out of our bleating sheephood and bring us to our true lion-like nature. So at the age of 12, where the Bible goes silent, and it is now accepted that those years were taken out of the Bible because, for various reasons, the institutional, you know, controllers of the teachings of Jesus, which turned it, as Master called it, from Christianity to churchianity, thought that people would lose faith if they thought Jesus had to go and study. But he did. He went to the feet of his own gurus. He did 18 years of ministry in India before he knew it was time to come back and finish the story for which the story that the world knows. And the Bible just remains silent because they didn't want to tell what happened, but they also didn't want to invent something, because it's impossible that Jesus didn't tell his disciples where he was for all that time. But in any case, this is the 3 years. So he appears with this tremendous power that he was born with. But now he's a grown man, and he's had this tremendous ministry in India, and he just steps forward to his own people because he was the avatar to the Essenes, to the Jews of that period of time. He'd come to bring them another stage in their own spiritual understanding. He came to bring the souls who were ready, whatever their birth, their affiliation, none of that matters. It's always soul to soul with God and Guru. So Jesus bursts on the scene with this tremendous power. And it is the power of miracles. It is the power that he can walk on water, that he can calm the stormy sea, that he can appear and then disappear. And also that he can raise the dead, that he can heal the sick, that he can make the blind see. And this makes a tremendous impression on people, as you can well imagine. And the time was a very tempestuous time politically and socially also, because this was all happening in the Jewish community with the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the third group was the Essenes. And the Essenes were the more mystical inward branch of Judaism, and the Pharisees and the Sadducees were the ones who ran the temple and who were the priests. They were the apparent power. And the Essene power was a more underground power, even a somewhat, in some cases, a slightly secret power, because institutional religion is always a little threatened by mystical religion, because institutional religion is based on being able to control the people, to direct, to be able to tell them, this is what you have to do for your salvation, and we are critical to your salvation. Institutional religion is not having it organized and knowing what you're doing. It's not having buildings. It's not having priesthoods. It's not having ritual. It's when the institution makes itself essential to the salvation of the individual. You must be a member of this church. You can only reach God through this ritual. The priest has to intercede for you. That's when it becomes institutional, because the relationship is always between the individual and God, and the priest and the organization and the ritual can all help inspire that inward experience. But when there is finally the soul to God, there is nothing in between. The disciple goes to the guru introduces you to God, and then it is soul to soul. It is the perfect divine romance, and that's what it is. At the time, Judaism had become an institutional religion. The Essenes were holding the inner communion side of it. The priesthood, as priesthoods do, had become enamored of its own power. So Jesus is there bringing back to the people not just the idea that, you know, that God is your father and that he loves you and you are his son and everything that God, that is from God belongs to you, and chasing the money changers out of the church. You have made of my father's house a house of commerce. When I was in Israel recently, I heard a slight clarification of that, which was that money had to be exchanged. People who brought money from other parts of the country, all money had to be exchanged for a temple coin. This is how it was told to me. And of course, every time they exchanged their money, a little bit of it went off into the temple. So that's why it was called the money changers. You had to make offerings. You had to prove your loyalty by giving something material, and that was, you had to make a certain money offering, but you couldn't even use your own coins. You had to change it into temple coins. So everybody who came in, the institution took a little off the top. And the priests and the temple became richer and richer, and Jesus was outraged. How dare you do this to God's children? And he took up his whips and he drove the money changers out of the temple. Jesus was, as you can well imagine, extremely controversial, because all the power that seemed to hold the power not only of salvation, but of worldly power too, was being threatened by him. And the way, however, he was able to have that power was not by being more forceful in the ways of the world, but by bringing to people this extraordinary experience of the divine. And power is an aspect of the divine, but so is joy, and so is love, and so is peace. And that's what people felt. You don't follow someone the way people were able to follow Jesus, the way they were spontaneously drawn to follow him, unless it is blissfully, blissfully enlightening to do so. And then Jesus confirmed that experience by consistently manifesting these powers that were way beyond anything anyone ever knew. But the real message, the real persuasive message, was what it awakened in the disciples. But there was this tremendous conflict building, because the established religious structure saw that in what Jesus was teaching, it was going to undermine their power and position. And power and position does not give up lightly. And so this constant conflict was building, and Jesus was baiting it. And the center of that power was Jerusalem. But Jesus also had his ministry by the Sea of Galilee. And so he would alternate during these 3 years. He would come into Jerusalem. He would go into the temple. He would argue with the priests. He would manifest his power. He would reinterpret the scripture. These confrontations would come right to here. And then Jesus literally sometimes would just disappear. Sometimes the authorities were going after him, and then they couldn't find him. And then he would walk off again and go back to Capernaum and to where the Essene communities were there and up by the Sea of Galilee, which even today is still very serene compared to the city of Jerusalem. And then he would work with his disciples out in the hills, the Sermon on the Mount, the Mount of Transfiguration, where his full glory was revealed to a handful of disciples. And then he would feel called again to come back to Jerusalem. And word would spread everywhere. And so by the time we get to this Sunday, which is the beginning of Easter week, Jesus knows in his heart that now is the time. He's trained his disciples. He's given them as much as they are able to receive. And he knows that this final dramatic demonstration of who he is and what his mission is looming on the horizon. And it begins to be centered around the Passover holiday, which is, of course, this huge celebratory event for the Jewish people because it's the beginning of Judaism, actually. You see, the Jews were, the people who became the Jews, or were the Jews, were enslaved in Egypt, and a great avatar, Master said that Moses, the founding avatar of Judaism, was himself a self-realized master, and he was sent by God because the Jewish people have, the way it's expressed is they are the chosen of God, but as we say in the Festival of Light, God chooses those of every race and nation who choose him. And so the Jewish people have always been this cultural opportunity. According to Judaism, being Jewish is an eternal identity. According to Sanatana Dharma, Judaism is a vibration of potential that souls choose to incarnate into when it provides for them the right learning experience. But the Jews have always been about God. Always about God. So there they were, enslaved, and the prayer of love went up from earth, and God responded. This is a line from the festival. And Moses was there, and Moses led them out of captivity, received the Ten Commandments, which was the guiding principles for their spiritual lives, took them through the wilderness, perhaps through the desert, but also the wilderness of inner experience, and delivered them to the Promised Land. And that's what Judaism is. That's how it became what it is. So let me just think for a second. Where was I? So there he is. Here we are, this story. Oh, so anyway, so the confrontation, I just completely lost the thought there. I'm thinking about Moses. I'm thinking the Mount of Transfiguration. I have to forgive me for a moment. I was just there in January, and I'm sitting on the Mount of Transfiguration thinking about Jesus appearing in light with Moses on one side and Elijah on the other. Oh, it's such a story. But now we're back. Oh, yes. So the Passover. The Passover celebrates that one of the ways that Moses got the Pharaoh to release the Jewish people, which he absolutely refused to do, is Moses called down all these plagues upon the land of Egypt, frogs and locusts and, I don't remember, fire. I mean, all kinds of things. It was bad. It was real bad. And Moses kept coming in and threatening, and the Pharaoh wouldn't do it. And finally, Moses declared that he was going to take the life of the firstborn of every Egyptian family, firstborn son of every Egyptian family. And the Jews took of the blood of a lamb and marked their doorways so that the angel of death would pass them by, would pass over them. So the angel of death passed over the Jewish families but took the firstborn son of every Egyptian family because Pharaoh was defying the will of God and Moses had the power. It was a very dark time. And that's what happened exactly. And then, of course, the Pharaoh was horrified and released the Jewish people. So this is a huge, you know, celebration every year, which magnificent celebration, which tends to coincide in the same season as Easter. And so pious Jewish people in the time of Jesus would want to go to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover. So the Passover is coming, and this is what Helen read at the beginning from the Bible. Everybody's saying one to another, do you think he'll come? All the Jewish people are going to be here. Do you think Jesus is going to come? What's going to happen? Everyone could feel it. And so Jesus decides and he tells his people, yes, we will celebrate the Passover in Jerusalem. So he comes with his disciples. They go to the Garden of Gethsemane, which is just outside the walls of what is Jerusalem, the city of Jerusalem. They gather there. And then instead of just slipping in through the gate, Jesus decides that they're going to make a triumphant entry. And whereas Jesus until now has always to a very large extent, shunned, you know, the accolades of all his people. They've wanted to do it, but he's not allowed them to do it. Now, he says, put me on the back of a donkey, and he tells them where to find it, and we will process into the city. So all of a sudden, they're walking in this way, and the sheer spiritual power of Jesus just creates this reality. And all of a sudden, all the people are singing and praising God, the Son of David, which is the biblical prediction of who the Messiah would be. He would be of the house of David, because the Jewish tradition was all written that the Messiah will return. They understood in their own language the descent of the Avatar when the need is there. So now they're proclaiming this, and then people are so moved, just spontaneously moved, that they start stripping branches off the tree and laying it before the donkey to make a walkway of greenery as he comes into the city. People are taking off their own cloaks for the blessing of having the donkey that is carrying the Messiah step on their cloak, and then their cloak will become a holy garment. And it's just riotous, riotous with joy. And the Pharisees, the priests are just, this is horrible. This is not anything they want to see. So they go to Jesus and say, I mean, on the donkey he's riding in, rebuke your disciples. This is unseemly. And this time Jesus said, if I were to silence them, the very stones would cry out. And what Jesus is saying, this is not of man, saying, this is not of man. It is not my disciples. They are giving voice to the jubilation of creation that God has taken visible form. Now, Jesus didn't say that, but he was saying that. It wasn't personal. It wasn't I, Jesus, the human ego, the single body. He was just saying the divine is present everywhere and the divine is manifest through this form. I and my Father are one. This is what he said. If you have seen the Son, you have seen the Father. These are all cosmic truths that the Bhagavad Gita makes perfectly clear, that in the Bible are singular, but in the Gita come into context, which is why Master always wanted to put the Gita and the Bible together, because then they make sense. So now the people feel, you know, this is Sunday, and by Friday, Jesus will be crucified. By Sunday, he will be resurrected. But now they think, this is it. You know, we're going to take over the temple. This is it. We're probably going to throw off the Roman yoke. This is it. And for the next days, up until late Thursday night, it's all celebration and excitement. And there's further conflict with the priest, but even the Bible reading ends. The priests say, what are we going to do? The whole world is running after him. But they give very serious thought to what they're going to do. And with the help of Judas, who it would have happened anyway, but Jesus was the instrument, they arrest him and ultimately crucify him. But nobody knows that. Not now, only Jesus. And perhaps those with deep intuition. But he doesn't tell them. He hints at it, but he doesn't tell them. So there's this great expectation, which is going to be fulfilled, because Jesus triumphs over every power, everything the world can throw at him, including terrible death. He laughs at it. And on Easter morning, he stands fully risen, and that is the message of this. But the other message is this: my ways are not thy ways, saith the Lord. And this is the lesson that we have to learn, which is we think we know how it's supposed to go. And this Easter story, there's nothing more dramatic, illustrative, that my ways are not thy ways, saith the Lord. But as Jesus also said, one of my favorite phrases, the world will hate you because you are my disciples. And he doesn't just mean that you'll be persecuted, which they were. He also meant that the ways of the world are antithetical to the ways of the devotee. The Gita says, what is day to the worldly man is night to the yogi. What is night to the worldly man is day to the yogi, "Thy ways, my ways are not thy ways, saith the Lord." So Jesus said, the world will hate you. You will not be able to live like everyone else lives. But then Jesus says, I always just sort of picture him saying it sort of like this, "Be of good cheer. I have conquered the world." And he has conquered the world. And so can we. By his grace, by God's grace, and by our lion-like power. But the story, the plot of the story is very, very different. And the only thing that carries us through is that inner experience that transcends all of the waves of this world. I know who I am. I am a lion of self-realization, lost for a time in the flock of sheep. But God says, gaze at your true image in meditation and know yourself for who you really are. God bless you.